evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza, working on this pre-recorded program very much. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 19, 2021. South Sudan's foreign minister says the visit by Sudan's prime minister aims to discuss the crisis within the SPLM-IO.
The manifestation of this split is perceived as a manifestation of the whole process. That's why people are very much concerned to revitalize and to support further the government of South Sudan to implement the agreement.
And five people were killed during a road ambush in eastern Equatoria State.
Some gunmen attacked the vehicles and five people were actually mentioned dead so far. And there are a couple of also wounded people also in that car.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese officials say the Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok arrived in Juba Thursday to strengthen peace efforts in South Sudan. Hamdok, who is also the chairman of the Regional Bloc Intergovernmental Authority for Development, known as IGAD, is expected to meet President Salva Kiir, First Vice President Riek Machar and other stakeholders to discuss recent split within the former rebels of the SPLM-IO. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Prime Minister Hamdok was accompanied by Sudanese Foreign Affairs Minister Mariam As-Sadiq Al-Mahdi and other top Sudanese officials. Speaking to reporters alongside her South Sudanese counterpart at Juba International Airport, As-Sadiq said Sudanese and South Sudanese officials expect to discuss the challenges affecting the implementation of the peace agreement as well as strengthening ties between the two neighboring countries. As-Sadiq says the regional bloc Intergovernmental Authority on Development, now headed by Prime Minister Hamdok, is concerned about the slow implementation of the peace deal, noting the end of the transitional period is fast approaching, but several security arrangements have not yet been implemented.
All the assessment, even from the people who overseeing the implementation of the peace agreement, and that we all commend it, and we are observing the very positive developments that's taking place within the implementation of the peace agreement, but there is still very observed slowness.
As-Sadiq says a top agenda item will be the much-discussed split within the SPLM-IO, which the minister says could be a threat to the implementation of the peace deal. She also says officials will focus on moving forward the implementation of the security arrangements defined in Chapter 2 of the South Sudan peace deal.
And many of the observations regarding the integration of the armed groups and all that, the manifestation of this split is perceived as a manifestation of the whole process. That's why people are very much concerned to revitalize and to support further the government of South Sudan to implement the agreement.
Hamdok is also expected to meet with the leaders of the parties who signed the peace deal, as well as Troika officials and IGAD envoy to South Sudan. His visit follows a visit by the executive director of IGAD, Wekne Gebeyehu, last week, who also met with President Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar. Gebeyehu said the situation within the SPLM-IO camp needed to be resolved as quickly as possible and called it an internal matter. Fighting broke out within SPLM-IO nearly 2 weeks ago after Machar's former chief of general staff, Simon Gadwich-Dual, described Machar was ousted as the party's leader and he was the new interim leader of the SPLM-IO. Senior members of Machar's faction, including his former deputy Henry Odwar, later switched their allegiance to Gadwich, accusing Machar of single-handedly running all SPLM-IO party affairs. Following an IGAD Council of Ministers meeting last week on the internal strife within the SPLM-IO, the regional body released a communique saying the party split is beyond an intra-party crisis and bears significant immediate and long-term implications for the 2018 peace deal and therefore called for collective efforts to address it. South Sudan Minister of Foreign Affairs Beatrice Kamisa says the split within the SPLM-IO will be topping the agenda in discussions between the two leaders, but they will also talk about bilateral issues.
We have over the years signed cooperation agreements between South Sudan and Sudan. I think those will be examined by the various ministers in South Sudan and their counterparts. But also, His Excellency Dr. Hamdok will discuss with His Excellency President Salva Kiir issues of the implementation of the peace agreement and especially the recent developments in McGuinness.
Although Kamisa did not mention the types of bilateral agreements the leaders would review, Juba and Khartoum have signed cooperation agreements on citizenship, border issues, and improving trade between the two countries. Nearly 3 years after the South Sudanese parties signed a peace deal, security arrangements have largely remained unimplemented. IGAD has described the security arrangements as the backbone of the revitalized peace deal and urged the government to complete the arrangements, including the graduation of unified forces and their redeployment. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on Sudan, over 55,000 people across Sudan have been affected by heavy rains and floods. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan says 11 out of 18 states are affected, with 7,500 homes destroyed and unconfirmed number of public infrastructure and farmlands affected. For VOA News, Michael Atid reports from Khartoum.
The UN Humanitarian Agency in Sudan says heavy rains and flash flooding have been reported in 11 out of Sudan's 18 states. They include Al Jazeera, Gadarif, Khartoum, North Kordofan, Northern, River Nile, Sinar, South Darfur, South Kordofan, West Darfur, and White Nile. Speaking to this program, Alimbek Tashkan Clove, UN OCHA's reporting officer in Khartoum, says 55,700 people across the country were affected by heavy rains and flooding as of August 19. He says more than 3,600 homes were destroyed, 7,500 homes were damaged, and an unconfirmed number of public infrastructures and farmland have been affected.
Further assessments will take place in Al Jazeera, Gedaref, Northern and White Nile states to verify the needs and the number of people affected. There are stockouts of relief supplies in water, sanitation and hygiene, shelter and non-food items, education, child protection and gender-based violence.
The UN official says $614 million was contributed to humanitarian action in Sudan, which includes $466 million for the 2021 Sudan Humanitarian Response Plan, which was appealing for $1.9 billion.
The Sudan Humanitarian Fund has been supporting flood response. It has allocated $3.1 million to 10 NGO partners in 10 states to finance a swift response to any emergencies, including floods. In addition, approximately $7 million has been allocated to 4 UN agencies for the procurement of emergency stock pipelines.
The Sudan Humanitarian Fund is a multi-donor country-based pool fund managed by UN OCHA in Sudan under the leadership of the Humanitarian Coordinator. It receives an earmarked contribution from donors into a single fund, which is used to ongoing humanitarian operations and to respond to new emergencies in Sudan. Tashkan Clove says the switch disbursement of Sudan humanitarian funds allow operational partners to act quickly, providing life-saving assistance to the most vulnerable. Last week, the Sudanese Meteorological Authority said thousands of homes have been destroyed in many parts of the country due to flooding caused by heavy rains. Muhammad Saifuddin, a spokesperson for the Sudanese Meteorological Department, confirms thousands of Sudanese families have been displaced in Sinar, Blue Nile, West Darfur, and River Nile states after their houses were destroyed by heavy rains. Saifuddin is warning providing business owners and residents with structures near the River Nile and people in lower layer areas to take precautionary measures in order to avoid being victimized by the flood.
We encourage our citizens who are living in open areas and those who are living next to the Blue Nile, White Nile and the main River Nile to take necessary precautions and stay away from the streams and torrents of the river.
Last year, the transitional government declared a three-month state of emergency in flood-affected areas. At least 100 people were killed in the floods. Thousands of others lost their homes. For VOA News, I'm Michael Atit in Khartoum.
From Khartoum, we move to Kapoita, where five people were killed and six others wounded following an ambush along the Torit-Kapoita Road in eastern Equatoria State. The state's information minister says authorities do not know the identity of the attackers or the motive behind the attack. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
Patrick Oting, Information and Communications Minister for Eastern Equatoria State, says an unspecified number of private vehicles were traveling from Tori to Kapoita when they fall into an ambush in a place called Singeta on Wednesday.
Some gunmen attacked the vehicles and five people were actually mentioned dead so far. And there are a couple of also wounded people also in that car. From the six, I think other vehicles maneuvered and the three were remaining in the site. And those who ambushed the car, they came and looted everything on the three vehicles that remained.
The Eastern Equatoria State Minister of Information says the wounded were rushed to a hospital in Kapoita South County and are receiving treatment for gunshot wounds. He says no arrests have been made, adding state authorities are doing their best to identify the attackers.
As a government, we are looking towards to see those who are involved, trying to trace their footmarks where they have taken off. We have our Honorable Governor flown right now from Juba to Kapoita and trying to find out more about that incident.
Oting says attacks on passenger vehicles have diminished in the Kapoita region in recent months.
This road was now a bit okay. People are moving. There was not any problems. It has just started and we'll follow about it. Apart from other minor issues of cattle wrestling between village and village, community and communities like that. Those are minor incidents that are happening. But an ambush is along the way like this. It has taken long without happening.
Beside the Torit-Kapoita Road attack, a separate ambush occurred on Monday along the Juba-Numili Highway, which left five people dead, including two Catholic nuns who were returning to Juba from Lowa. The nuns were in Lowa to take part in centenary celebrations of the Catholic Church. The police arrested a number of people in connection with Monday's attack, but later released them, saying the suspects were charcoal burners going about their business not far from the crime scene. In a press statement released on Tuesday, President Salva Kiir accused the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, a non-signatory to the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement, of being behind the road ambushes. The president threatened to withdraw from the Rome peace process. The South Sudan Opposition Alliance immediately denied being involved in either of the attacks. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayar in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, local non-profits in South Sudan face challenges. Find out more after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
where do you get your health advice from?
Sometimes I get my health advice from my grandmother who is at home. When I'm sick that I can't control myself, she'll help.
I get my health advice from my friend, colleague, who live together. We also know about those who have been experiencing more problems about health. They don't advise me through phone. We talk, we chat, discuss everything.
My dad, because my dad is a doctor.
I'd say I get my health advice from various places, the internet, my parents, because I have, my mother is a nurse.
My health advice, I get it on the internet. If I need something on how to deal with obesity, I get it on the internet. Anything I need pertaining to health advice is on the internet.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Some South Sudanese humanitarian workers say they continue to face insecurity and lack of access to some parts of the country as South Sudan joins the rest of the world to mark the International Humanitarian Day. Aid workers in South Sudan are calling on the government to provide security and enact policies that protect humanitarian workers. For VOA News, Winnie Chirino reports from Juba.
Gala Isaac-Steven is a protection manager at Israel Aid, an international humanitarian agency that delivers humanitarian aids to affected areas and provides gender-based violence and child protection programs. Steven says he frequently travels to other states to provide humanitarian assistance. But Steven says he has been facing continuous challenges, including resistance from authorities who at times have either denied access to certain areas or delayed clearing his travel to specific locations. Steven says there is a lot of bureaucracy involved in gaining access to certain areas, and insecurity remains a big challenge to humanitarian workers.
For example, we are doing a response in Kajokeji, and you know Kajokeji has different authorities. The other side sometimes is controlled by the government, the other side is controlled by another, by armed opposition. So it's so difficult sometimes in terms of coordinating the two structures. And you find each side have their own terms and conditions that sometimes it's really not easy for humanitarian workers.
Steven says he lost both of his parents during the war which led to South Sudan's independence, and as a result grew up with a lot of pain. He says he wouldn't want to see other South Sudanese go through the same circumstances in this generation. Steven is calling on the government to protect humanitarian workers so they can easily deliver assistance to the needy.
I will encourage both government and other armed groups, I will encourage them to really create policies that are friendly for humanitarian access, so that at the end of the day, we as humanitarian workers were able to deliver our work because we are neutral. We have no other political whatever affiliation. We are totally independent. So, and we are here to save lives. So for us to do our work better, so we, of course, need the guidance from the government.
Susan Pascal, director for the Women's Advancement Organization, a local humanitarian agency that focuses on gender issues, says she has been to a number of states but finds it difficult to access some areas because of threats from armed robbers.
I've been in Fangak, moving in between Fangak and Korwai. That involves only walking. You walk and you swim in the swampy areas because there's no road. And also with a lot of fear, because anytime you can find in unknown gunmen, and they can cause any harm to somebody, to humanitarian workers. So the accessibility to the various counties and the community, the Payam, has been a huge challenge.
Pascal blames the attacks on the slow implementation of the peace agreement, saying soldiers continue to attack aid workers and other people because they are not unified and receive little, if any, financial support from the government. Buan Kun, a protection manager at Intersols, an international humanitarian aid organization operating in South Sudan, says he sometimes feels he is targeted for no apparent reason, even though his work involves providing assistance to the needy. He too says the government needs to provide more security for aid workers.
We don't get adequate protection from the government, something that we felt our government should do, but instead we don't. As nationals of South Sudan, there's no one that will protect us apart from the government of South Sudan. So on this matter, maybe I wanted the government to value the work, the humanitarian works that the nationals are doing, and provide the needed protection that the nationals need, so that they continue serving the peoples of South Sudan.
In a recent press release on South Sudan, the UN said, quote, "Since March 2021, there has been a rise in the number of attacks against aid workers who serve the community. Ambushes and attacks on clearly marked humanitarian convoys, including ambulances, also increased. 4 aid workers were killed carrying out their duties this year. The deaths bring the number of aid workers killed in South Sudan since 2013, when conflict broke out, to 128. Most were South Sudanese," end quote. Lawrence Akola, the Director General at South Sudan Humanitarian Affairs Ministry, says he is aware that aid workers are being denied access or being attacked in some areas, but says the number of violent incidents involving aid workers has diminished.
We are aware of what's going, and the number of restrictions has become now lower and lower because we have involved the security. But however, what you know in South Sudan here, we have sometimes armed groups. We don't know where they belong to, but the government is trying its best to control.
Akola says his ministry has directed security operatives to allow unfettered access to humanitarian workers in all areas of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Mogadishu, where Amnesty International says Somalia's struggling healthcare system has been crippled by the coronavirus pandemic. The group released a report Wednesday titled, "We Just Watched COVID-19 Patients Die." The report calls for urgent intervention in Somalia's healthcare sector after years of neglect. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Amnesty International's 27-page report on Somalia's healthcare says the global pandemic has hit the struggling sector hard. The Amnesty report quoted a senior Somali doctor saying in one ward on the same day four elderly men died within 10 minutes because of lack of oxygen. The Rice Group Somali researcher Abdullahi Hassan says health resources are so poor that medical workers too often could only stand by and watch their patients die.
When COVID-19 pandemic came, it laid bare how bad the situation was in Somalia. For example, the response by the government was wholly inadequate. There was only one hospital in Mogadishu that managed COVID-related cases, and that one hospital lacked essential equipment. Health workers who worked in that hospital, they really struggled with patients. They did not have enough equipment. They did not have oxygen supply.
Amnesty says the Somali government allocates only 2% of its budget to healthcare, while security services got the largest share, 31%. Officially, Somalia has had more than 16,000 infections and almost 900 deaths from COVID. But the country's chief medical officer, Dr. Mohamed Mahmoud Ali, told Amnesty the death toll was certainly far higher. Dr. Ali said only those who managed to get to the health facilities and get tested were included official data. The figure is just the tip of the iceberg, Amnesty quoted him saying. Many more were infected and died at home. Amnesty notes that only 15% of Somalia's rural population have access to medical care, and the country has only one surgeon for every 1 million people. Abdikadir Abdirahman Aden is the founder of the Amin Ambulance Service, the only such service for Mogadishu residents. Aden says they have two ambulances to serve people. The ambulance workers get exhausted and it's challenging to get oxygen. Since they provide a free service to people and the companies producing oxygen want money, he says they have problems with oxygen supply. Aden says their ambulance workers are also not very well trained to handle some health issues. The Amnesty report, based on interviews with 33 medical and aid workers, as well as officials and experts, calls on Somalia to use debt relief to invest more in healthcare. In March 2020, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank reduced Somalia's debt from $5.2 billion to $557 million over 3 years. The debt relief aims to bring the Horn of African nation back into the global economy after 30 years of conflict and unstable governments. Amnesty's Hassan says the debt relief also offers an opportunity to improve Somali hospitals.
All this money that is going to be received through debt relief should be managed in a manner that is transparent, that's accountable, and it should be used to improve the health sector in the country.
Ambulance service operator Aden says the health sector desperately needs more medical experts to revive it.
He said this sector requires knowledge. The people leading the health sector and working on policies, says Aden, must be people who have a background in health and medicine. If you are going to have people in the health sector who are not familiar with the health system, he says, then it is difficult to improve the health system. Amnesty notes only 0.6% of Somalis have been fully vaccinated against the coronavirus. While a shortage of vaccine is partly to blame, Amnesty says that 19 of the 33 healthcare workers it interviewed in the report refused to take the vaccine despite having it offered. It blamed widespread vaccine hesitancy in part on lack of public information. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Still on COVID, the United States is defending its plan to offer COVID-19 booster shots amid sharp criticism from the World Health Organization. AP Washington correspondent Shaga Megini reports.
WHO Emergencies Chief Michael Ryan says poor nations don't even have enough vaccine to give their people a first shot.
We're planning to hand out extra life jackets to people who already have life jackets while we're leaving other people to drown without a single life jacket.
Here in Washington,
I do not accept the idea that we have to choose between America and the world.
Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says there's a responsibility to both. White House officials say the U.S. has donated 115 million vaccine doses to 80 nations, more than all other countries combined. Sagar Magani, Washington.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1-202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1-202-630-8011.
Let us know what you think about this show. Our WhatsApp number is +1-202-630-8011. We reserve the right to read your brief comments every Friday. That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We now leave you with some traditional Acholi song from Eastern Equatorial State. Listening to some traditional Acholi song from Eastern Equatorial State. I'm John Tanza. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're in public places to protect you and others from getting COVID-19. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there's no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.